Well, I guess this will be the open to the program. It's the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we've got quite a few articles that we're going to look at from Entomology Today.
And recent insect stuff.
We'd love to have you join our conversation if something piques your interest, and our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So let's just launch right into this. The first one that piqued my interest was one titled "A Natural Born Stink Bug Killer Found in Washington State." Now, brown marmorated stink bug is causing quite a bit of devastation in the east, and apparently there's an established population now in Salt Lake. So anything that might help take care of this pest a little bit or suppress it is of interest.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I had heard about this through the tree fruit entomology kind of groups that I work with as soon as they had discovered this particular parasitoid wasp. That's what it is. It's a very tiny wasp, so you don't think of a killer as being something that small, but it is very devastating to the brown marmorated stink bug. And the brown marmorated stink bug is native to Asia, so China, Korea, Japan, those parts of the world. And it was inadvertently introduced into the eastern United States somehow about 20 years ago. And it took about 10 years before it built up to be very abundant and started then causing problems in some of the agricultural commodities, in particular fruit, especially soft fruits.
And it seems to go after a lot of different hosts, not just one specific.
No, and it utilizes corn and soybeans there in the east and lots of ornamental plants to feed on and have it, you know, help its life cycle continue. And so it's a major economically damaging pest of crops in the east. And this stink bug was first found here about 5 years ago in the western part of the United States. And we haven't yet seen it, you know, build up to like agriculturally damaging populations, but there is that concern. And so you mentioned that there is an established population in the Salt Lake Valley area, especially along the Eastern Bench, the Avenues, the University of Utah, Red Butte Gardens, that kind of area in particular. And this past year, Dr. Lori Spears, our Cooperative Agriculture Pest Survey Coordinator, she did a lot of monitoring for this insect, and they found abundant egg masses and nymphs hatching from those eggs, particularly, on a number of different ornamental plants that were there on the University of Utah campus, but widespread than that, too. And so now it's really cool that this wasp that is actually native to the brown marmorated stink bug. So it lives in Asia.
Is specific to the stink bug?
Well, that we're not 100% sure yet, but that's what we think, is that it's very specific to the brown marmorated stink bug. And now this wasp has been found in a number of different places in the east, as well as now in the west. And this wasp was identified or recognized as could be a potentially very important biological control agent by the USDA, five to 10 years ago in that range. And they actually made collections of it in different parts of Asia, but it's only been brought into very restrictive quarantine kinds of facilities, and all that's in the eastern part of the state, where they've been testing it to look at that host range factor, because we don't want to bring in, it has happened before, we have introduced beneficial, what we thought were beneficial insects, and then found out that, oh, they don't only attack the invasive pests, but they attack many of our native insects, some of which, you know, we don't want to harm, because if we harm those and they go down and other invasive things go up in their place. And so they've been doing studies for a number of years to look at the specificity of this wasp for just brown marmorated stink bug. And so far, it's looking like it's very specific. But they weren't yet ready to release it out of quarantine and start distributing it around the United States and Canada, where the brown marmorated now occurs. But all on its own, this wasp seems to have hitched a ride, probably, with brown marmorated stink bug eggs that were brought into the U.S. on some kind of plant material that was coming from Asia, or just the wasps themselves. The adult little tiny wasp may have, you know, somehow flown into an airplane, a cargo plane belly of the plane, and gotten in there and then, you know, made its way out. We don't know for sure how it came on its own, but it is now in a number of places in the East, and now most recently was found in Washington State. So that's pretty cool.
What part of Washington?
I don't know exactly which town it was in, but it was a research technician from the Tree Fruit Research Extension Center up there, based out of Wenatchee. It wasn't in Wenatchee, but somewhere in eastern Washington.
So kind of central.
Right, and they
dry side of the
dry
the
side of the Cascades, and they were out looking for stink bug, for brown marmorated stink bug, and they found an egg mass that had been parasitized, and they found this wasp. They collected it, and they found this wasp emerging from it. So there it was, all on its own. The wasp itself had not been purposely brought in by humans.
And where does the stink bug originate from? Where is it? Home.
So different parts of Asia. So some genetic research that's been done in the eastern part of the United States shows most genetic similarity between stink bugs there and stink bugs around Beijing, China. But we do believe there's been multiple introductions of the brown marmorated stink bug. And not surprising, I mean, we now have it in the West, so it, you know, certainly it can move from the eastern part of the state of the country to the west, but probably also have been multiple introductions and probably came in most likely as eggs or nymphs, because those are the small stages. You don't tend to notice them as easily on some kind of plant material that was imported into the United States.
So is it just me, or does it seem like a lot of invasives, both plants and insects, come from Asia?
Yeah. So, and this has happened in the last, 20 to 30-ish years, and this is, if you can really relate this directly to when our marketing and exchange of supplies, products really opened up with the Asian markets. Yes. So soon, if you look back in time to some of our older invasive pests, a lot of them came from Europe, mm-hmm, because we mm-hmm. obviously had a lot of trade with Europe going way back to when, the colonists first came here to this country. But we hadn't had as much marketing exchange with some of the Asian countries, especially China, until more recently. So you're right.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Are there any clues as to, is this particular wasp going to attack other stink bugs?
Well, that's what the quarantine work had all been, done for, to make sure that it didn't have a more expansive host range, even though we say, well, why would we care if it attacks other stink bugs? But we do have some, we do have native stink bugs here. Some of them feed on plants, but some of them are also predators. And if you bring in a parasitic wasp and then it starts attacking some of our native predatory stink bugs, that's a really bad thing, because then we might end up with actually more stink bug problems. And so that's what all the quarantine work has been carried out for. And so far, based on what I've heard from those studies, it looks like it's quite specific. They have not been able to get it to attack other species of stink bugs. So we're hoping, fingers crossed, now that it's out of the bag. But on the other hand, it also shows that this wasp is going to be adapted here, and it can survive, and it's attacking brown marmorated stink bug already in this country. So we're hoping that it is very specific for just brown marmorated, and it will provide a very good biological control and help keep that stink bug from causing as much economic damage as it has in the east.
And central Washington is a drier part of the mm-hmm. state. It's not as dry as Utah, but still, you'd think if it can survive there, it might.
It should be able to, right.
So would they still be reticent about releasing it, even though it's already released?
I think that's kind of the next step that's going to be going on now. I'm just getting ready to head to the National Entomology Meetings this next week. They're in Minneapolis, and I know there's going to be lots of that kind of talk. So now what? The cat's out of the bag with this Trisulcus wasp, and so are we going to start moving it around intentionally? And I we'll see what happens, but my guess is yes, that will happen.
So tell me about an entomology conference. Are you like really excited to go?
Oh, yeah, I always am. It's so, I mean, they're over. These national conferences of any topic, whatever area you work in, they tend to be overwhelming. I mean, there's just so many people, so much going on, so many different topics. And I always feel like, oh, I wish I could have been at that session. But, you know, instead I picked this other session because you just can't go to them all. But a lot of it is just networking too, especially at this point in my career. I tend to go to a lot of student talks because I think those are exciting, seeing the young scientists up and coming, and they often give some of the really best talks. But then a lot of the rest of it is just, I pick a few symposia, so these are kind of longer talks that interest me on topics that I work in and want to know more about. But otherwise, it's just a lot of, you know, talking to your colleagues from around. It has international participation as well, even though it's a national conference, but your colleagues from around the world and, you know, catching up on what they're working on and making those connections to, to work for new grant proposals, you know, linking up with people. In fact, we have a team from across the U.S. now that is getting ready to we're working on a grant proposal to work on brown marmorated stink bug. And I'm sure this Trisulcus japonicus, this new parasitic wasp, is going to be a part of that.
I'm just thinking, for most people, the Public Media Development and Marketing Conference, which is one that I've been to a number of times, probably wouldn't be all that exciting. But going to an entomology conference, to me, that sounds like that would be kind of
fun. Oh, it's fun. And they have a great, vendor display, too, where you can buy lots of cool insect-related things, including, I always go for the earrings or the pendants, you know, the jewelry kind of stuff. But they have all kinds of neat, fun things, T-shirts, of course.
The insect and amber earrings,
yes,
that sort of
those
stuff.
Those kind of things. And there's this one group of people that they, you're familiar with rock rollers. They're the little caddisfly larvae that live in creeks. But they make their own little fake creek, and they put precious stone, little gemstones in there, and the caddisfly larvae stick those, to glue those together and make little very unique natural pendants out of very nice looking stones.
Wow. Okay. Head to Minneapolis. Well, our next topic is one that we've brought up many different times, but there's always seems to be more articles about mosquitoes than other insects. And I'm not quite sure why that is, but the first one we're looking at is male mosquitoes that are lured to traps by the sound of female wing beats.
Yeah, I think, you know, why are mosquitoes such a, I won't say popular, but a common topic? And it's because if you asked, you know, went up to someone on the street, you know, which insect do you like the best or like the least, or, you know, what do you want to know more about? The mosquitoes would come up a lot as the one that people don't like or, you know, want to avoid, learn how better to avoid, because we've all been bitten by mosquitoes and suffer through those itchy bites. But just think about if you lived in a country where some of the very devastating human diseases that these mosquitoes vector are common. Things like malaria, dengue, yellow fever, chikungunya, and one of these newer ones that we've heard about here in the United States, West Nile virus, and certainly in some of the hotter places and warmer places where mosquitoes occur, are a major human health concern. And so that is why mosquitoes are such a hot topic, not in a popular way, but in a way that we need to deal with them in a better way. And so I was very attracted to this article about this very low-cost way to attract mosquitoes. And so, I don't work with mosquitoes personally, but I'm always intrigued by the different kinds of traps that entomologists have developed to attract mosquitoes. And for females, it's often they involve carbon dioxide, because that's one of the things that attracts females to hosts, so like people and mammals and birds and other things, is giving off carbon dioxide. But those kinds of traps tend to be pretty expensive to operate, and so they're not very practical in a place, like in a third world country and an African location or something like that. And so what this group was looking at is, well, so it's hard to attract females, but what could we do to attract males? And they started looking in the literature and and working with male mosquitoes and found out, wow, there really is a strong attraction of males to this very specific wing beat frequency of the female of their own species. And so that's how males cue in on finding females to mate with, is they basically, they have these organs in their antennae. And a little side thing about how you can tell a male from a female mosquito, we'll talk about that in just a moment, but they have these little sensory organs on their antennae that detect, you know, sound frequency, and they're called Johnston's organs, and they're very cued in to responding just to their species. So there could be, you know, three, four different kind of different species of mosquitoes flying around, but a male of one species is very attracted to just the wing beat frequency of his female, so to speak. And so that's what they're taking advantage of. And then they feel like in a, again, in a third world country where they don't have a lot of money to run a trap, they can use something as simple as a little like watch battery. So something very small that will last a long time and run like a little recording, like an MP3 player, but not, I mean, something very simple, just a little tiny chip that emits this sound of the wing beat frequency of the female. And they can attract the males in, and then they can use that for monitoring, number one, so they can get an idea like how many of this kind of mosquito is in this area. Is this going to be a health concern for this village? Because we have a lot of, you know, the yellow fever carrying mosquito here.
Are the populations typically 50-50 as far as male?
Generally,
female?
Yeah, okay. I think so, typically. But also then, now they're looking at, we can do a very simple kind of irradiation where the male mosquito flies through a little tube when it comes into the trap. And then out the other end, and it irradiates it and it sterilizes it. But the male is still very active. It's going to go and seek out a female, mate with her, but her offspring will be inviable. Mm. And so then what they feel like is they could really have an impact on reducing populations. So how to tell a male from a female mosquito, do you know how?
I have no idea.
Okay, so if you ever have a mosquito land on you, I mean, most people are going to swat before they're even going to look,
exactly.
Right?
That's what I'm thinking.
But if you, this time of year in particular, I tend to see a lot of males, and I think it's because I had plants outdoors that I either dug up and put in pots for the winter, like my rosemary, for example, or because I had just pots of plants sitting out on my patio, and now I've brought them inside for the winter. And I think there's a lot of mosquitoes that can breed in that damp soil. But this time of year, I'll see these little mosquitoes flitting around my house, not a lot of them, but a few. And I notice almost all of them have very hairy or plumose feathery-like antennae. And those are the males, and that's and their antennae are designed that way because they have all the surface area. So if you can think about all the branches on a feather, has a little places for all these little receptor organs to detect that wing beat frequency of the female wing. Whereas a female mosquito just has a kind of a, you know, thread like straight antenna, does not have all that plumose surface area.
But when would I see the male? I mean, he's not going to be seeking me out.
It's, no,
it's
so they
the
don't
female.
They don't bite you, right?
Yeah.
But they're just, they're like I said, I think this time of year I see them in my house because they've come out of the soil of these house plants that I've brought in, and they're just. They're just wandering around, probably looking for a female, but of course, I'm hoping there's none around at this time of year.
Well, so I'm going to, while we're talking about insect control, why don't we look at the article that talks about natural repellents?
Yeah, that was a really interesting article, I thought.
And and some things that I've heard of before and wasn't sure if they ever worked or not, and some that I hadn't, and others I'm surprised that they do work. So.
Yeah, well, that was really interesting. So this was a group of scientists that is always the million-dollar question, you know, which mosquito repellent works the best? And there have been, you know, quite a bit of research on this over the past, and most people have heard of the chemical DEET. I forget exactly what it stands for. It's the, you know, capital DEET, and it stands for the chemical composition of what's in it. But we know that there's a lot of things we don't like about DEET. You know, it smells bad. It's probably, it's not that good for your skin. I know when I used to. It gets absorbed through your skin. I know when I was a graduate student in North Carolina working out in the soybean fields where mosquitoes were very common, and I'd lather myself in that, and then I'd go pick up those yellow pencils, you know, the typical, you know, number two lead pencils with the yellow paint on the sides, and that DEET would just melt that yellow paint on the pencil. It'll be all over my fingers. And I think, boy, if it's doing that to the yellow paint on this pencil, what is it doing to me as I spread that all over my body? And so we know that, like, currently recommendations from FDA are not to put DEET on young children, mm-hmm. and things like that. So we have some concerns about using DEET. So what else might work well? And so this group looked at some of these other comparing compounds. They looked at three different DEET products, but they also looked at some of these other ones that contain eucalyptus oil and lemon, and they looked at
the Avon Skin So Soft. That's what my mom always talked about.
That we've, you know, some has been promoted. They even looked at a Victoria's Secret bombshell perfume. I thought that was pretty interesting. And then also another one was a vitamin B1 patch, because that's been also another thing that's been shown to have some repellency to mosquitoes, is vitamin B1.
And this was done through New Mexico State. So,
right,
you know,
right.
to a regional campus and
right.
close to...
Right.
Us,
so. And so they looked at, so, and then another interesting thing, they looked at two different mosquitoes. So Aedes aegypti, which is the yellow fever mosquito, and then another one that's called the tiger mosquito. And they found some slightly different results with the two different mosquitoes. So that's a little surprising too. You'd think all mosquitoes are going to respond the same. So they did find that the DEET products in general worked quite well and lasted some mm-hmm. of the longest. And they looked up to 240 minutes, I believe, was how long they ran their trials. But they did find that for the yellow fever mosquito, Aedes aegypti, that the Cutter's lemon eucalyptus insect repellent also had a strong repellent effect for the full 240 minutes. So
it would certainly smell a lot better.
And it smells a lot better, and the I would assume that eucalyptus oil and lemon oil are not as potentially concerns for health concerns as is DEET. They also found that they looked at a bath oil product, and then this Victoria's Secret perfume also repelled mosquitoes for like 120 minutes. So not as long, didn't last as long as the DEET and the eucalyptus lemon, but it did provide some repellency. But then interestingly, with this other mosquito, the tiger mosquito, they didn't find that the DEET didn't work quite as well, but... The Skin So Soft had significant repellent effects for the tiger mosquito, but not for the yellow fever mosquito. So, you know, why is that? And again, the perfume showed some efficacy again. And so they do comment that they use the perfume at very high levels. So I suspect that it would be kind of, you know, maybe above a level that most people might wear it at in public. But they thought that was very interesting that the perfume... which they had thought, their hypothesis was that the perfume was actually going to attract the mosquitoes, but it actually seemed to repel them, at least at the high doses that they had used.
And they were saying that floral fragrances mm-hmm. may provide a masking odor, mm-hmm. resulting in low attraction rates.
Right. So I thought that was, some good information to help people make some choices about which kinds of repellents they might want to use.
Well, I want to go for the Cutter Lemon Eucalyptus Insect Repellent because I love citrus.
I do too. So. When I saw that, I'm gonna get some of that and try that this next summer.
I wonder how readily available it is.
I don't know to be honest.
And then in our last mosquito story, we have the carrier of not a good disease, a type of encephalitis.
Yeah, arboviral encephalitis.
This mosquito has now been found in Western Canada.
Yes. So this is so we've talked about there's different kinds of mosquitoes. A lot of people don't maybe realize how many different species of mosquitoes there are. We just think, you know, mosquitoes are all the same. And this is one called Aedes japonicus. So comes from the, you know, from Asia, Japan region, as the name suggests. And this mosquito is known from eastern North America already, that it has been brought there at some point in the past. But it had not been known very much from the west. But now they're discovering it in more places, and most recently around Vancouver, British Columbia was where this particular research group found it. And we, to our knowledge, the Aedes japonicus in North America doesn't yet carry this La Crosse encephalitis, this very damaging type of encephalitis, especially to children. But they have done experiments to show that the mosquitoes here are capable of carrying it. Mm. So this, I'm sure, was all done in the lab. I didn't read that article, but I'm sure that was all done in the lab. But it's capable of carrying it. And so, of course, we don't want another species of mosquito here that can carry a bad disease. But now we know that it's found in southern Washington, northern Oregon, and now most recently in Vancouver, Washington. And so it is an example of the range expansion of a disease vectoring mosquito that we should have concerns about and want to keep an eye on to help prevent it from becoming more common and potentially getting infected with the encephalitis or acquiring the encephalitis pathogen so that it could then vector it to people.
How do they collect mosquito eggs? Are they looking for the eggs and then raise them? Is that what they do?
So what they said in this particular case is they just use yogurt cups, so any kind of container, and they would scoop them out of standing water in particular is where mosquitoes most.
So they could see that there was something there.
They knew there were mosquito wigglers there, and they were just sampling to see what was there, and that was their sampling technique, was to go around to designated places that had standing water and just scoop it out, and then they would take it back to the lab under, you know, warm conditions and rear them out. And then when the adults emerge, the adults are a lot easier to identify than are the larvae.
It's pretty amazing how little water really is needed for mosquitoes.
Yes.
I remember in my very first apartment, there was water in the curb right there in the gutter, and not very deep. It couldn't have been more than an inch. But there were larvae in there.
Right.
Yeah.
So common places is people have like little children's swimming pools that they might leave some water in the bottom, certainly tires or other, you know, pots or saucers. And people say, oh, I want to have a bird bath. And as long as you change the water regularly or have some kind of circulating, you know, fountain with it, or then that's fine. But if you have standing water, so a lot of these are called like tree hole mosquitoes because they'll breed in these little pools of water that get in tree holes.
So the birds aren't going to eat them.
Well, they will, but they may not eat them all. And that's the point I was making earlier about just bringing these potted plants in. It's amazing to me how many mosquitoes are emerging from that soil, that moist soil. So there must have been enough water either standing in the saucer of the pot or just in the soil itself that once they come into the house and it's warm, you know, inside my house, and then they go out, they complete their development and they emerge. And I wouldn't think of that as really being standing water, but it's enough for some species.
Wow. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. We'd love to hear from you. Join our conversation at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. We have her for about another 15 minutes. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So the next one, of course, the title of it was what jumped out at me. Vampire moths suck the blood of vertebrates, including humans.
Yeah, who would have ever thought that a moth would be a vampire?
We've heard of vampire bats, but I wasn't thinking that an insect would do the same thing. Well, there are insects that will attack humans that we've talked about before. I've just never heard of moths.
Right. And when we tend to think of blood feeding insects, we think of mosquitoes and or their relatives like ticks or, you know, and things like that. But we don't tend to think of a moth. You know, moths are, they're very
assassin
tame.
Bugs maybe.
Yeah. But the moths, they feed on flowers, they feed on nectar and things like that. You know, what would they be doing drinking blood? But there is a group. I remember when I was an entomology graduate student and studying insect diversity and learned about this family of moths that had these potentially vampire-ish species in them. And this particular family that this article's about actually has eight different species of moths that can be vampires. And one thing that I thought was particularly interesting, besides just the fact that they would feed on human blood, is that in this case, it's the males. And that's the opposite of most blood feeding insects and their relatives. It's usually the female, because the female is feeding on blood because it's a good protein source that helps her develop her eggs so that she can, you know, be reproduced. But in this case, it's the males that do it, not the females. And what they think's going on is that the males are actually drinking the blood to get some salts. So they feel like maybe it's the salt that's important. And then they pass that along in their sperm to the female, which then helps her develop her eggs. It's a necessary, you know, component, a nutrient, but opposite of what we tend to think. But these are most so that said, sounds horrible, these moths going around feeding on people's blood. But really what they are is they're fruit juice feeding a moth. So that's mostly what they feed on is ripe fruit. And there's just some species that have evolved, in the case of the males, to take advantage of where there's the picture that they show is right along the cuticle of the thumb or the finger, mm-hmm. and that little soft tissue there where they can take advantage of getting a blood meal from a human. But most of the species, it's more on other kinds of mammals that live, you know, in nature.
And then it does say all but one of the species are found in the old world, where mm-hmm. There is one, Calyptra canadensis, mm-hmm. that's in the U.S. and Canada. I mean, they say, and that's probably not a vampire, but who knows?
They don't know. They've never shown for sure that it feeds on blood, but they're so cryptic where they live that, you know, maybe we just haven't observed them.
And it also did say that this particular one was almost unknown until recently about its life history. So there's still
there's
still
a lot that's unknown.
So unknown. So that moves us right into talking about new species that are continually being found, not just in places like Borneo, but also Alabama.
Right. Yeah. So that's what particularly attracted my eye to this article. It's about a whirligig beetle, which most people would say, what in the world is a whirligig beetle? It's an aquatic beetle that spins around on the water as it feeds and moves around. Thus gets the name whirligig. But what was particularly attractive was that, hey, here's a new species of whirligig beetle that's never been identified before in the United States. And they found it in this, given relatively remote kind of Tannic Creek area in southeastern Alabama. So some of these kind of hard to access places, there are still hot spots of biodiversity out there, even in the U.S., that we aren't fully aware of. You were talking to me before the show. Mostly we've detected most of the birds and the larger animals, and that's true. But when it comes to things like insects, there still are quite a few insects out there that haven't yet been discovered. And this was one that an entomologist, actually he's from New Mexico, but he was looking in this particular area because he was looking for new species of whirligig beetle, and he found one. And he was so excited when he did. And so I think it's just a kind of neat example that there's still these little backwater, if you want to call that, places, even in our own country, where you can find new species.
Well, and was it this particular species that had been found once, but they didn't know what it was?
Right.
And it was...
They actually found... Once he collected some fresh specimens and went to a museum, actually the University of Missouri, they found some specimens that were stored there that someone had collected back in the 70s but had never been identified. And so now they were able to move ahead. This particular individual went ahead and named the new species, and now they know that it exists there. And it was collected in the exact same place. So this very tiny little section of creek, just this one short little section of it, is the only place where they know that this particular species of whirligig beetle occurs.
And to me, that's really fascinating. Why hasn't it traveled further up or further down? What is it about that one section?
Right. It occurs in a very, very small area. So there's something about that habitat that's very particular for its to make its living. Also, there's other more common species of whirligig. And so that can be another thing, is they have to compete. They have to kind of fight for their space. And if those other more common species are better adapted to a little bit sunnier section of the creek, but these guys can specialize in the little bit shadier, I don't know that's the case, I'm just giving an example, then that's how they can kind of, you know, find their little niche and fit in. And whirligigs are an interesting beetle in that the adults, with this circular movement that they have as they go across the surface of the creek or pond, that's how they're looking for food. They feed on their detritivores, so they're kind of their scavengers. They feed on dead insects that have fallen on the creek surface, and they kind of keep the water clean. And then their larvae live under the water and are predators on other insects that live in the water.
I liked your comparison of how they cover their territory.
Yeah. Like, so what did I say? Now I can't remember.
You said it was like those vacuums.
Oh, those little robot vacuums that move around your room that you leave go. So that's what they're doing, is they're just kind of doing these random circular spinning around whirligig movements. But that's how they cover the surface and encounter their food.
Now, we don't have any of them in Utah.
We
may do, but we're not sure.
We do, but they tend to like little warmer water. And so a lot of our water in the northern part of the state in particular is pretty cold, and it tends to be fast moving. They like slower moving water. And so it's the kind of places
not a lot of bayous in Utah.
Exactly. It's the kind of places where you find a lot of frogs. Those are the kind of places where you're going to find the whirligig beetles. And we do. I've been in some places on the San Rafael Swell where we've had some wonderful frogs singing to us. So I will go. That's a place to look for a whirligig beetle, too.
and so what are the predators on the whirligig?
So what feeds on them? Mm-hmm. Some other larger insects. This particular one's about a little less than a half inch long. So they're not, they're not minuscule, but they're also not huge. So there's other larger aquatic insects that will feed on them. Also certainly birds, fish, those kind of animals that will feed on in and on water.
And I was thinking that these were the ones that I had seen. They're down at the bottom, and you see them come up to the top. And
right.
But those are the diving beetles.
Those are diving beetles. They have a lot of similar characters. And one cool thing about diving beetles as well as whirligigs is they carry a little water bubble, air bubble with mm-hmm. them, a little mm-hmm. plastron that's called. So it's kind of like a diver with an air tank, same kind of thing. And they use that. So when they do, because these guys will dive underwater to escape predators. They mostly spend their time on the surface, but if they're threatened, they'll dive. And that water, that air bubble they take with them is their air supply, because they're not, they can't feed, they don't have gills, they can't, breathe in the water.
Now, I did not tell you before the program I was going to ask this question, because I didn't even know it until now. Do you have a favorite insect?
Oh, wow. Yeah, people have asked me that before, and I don't really have...
I can imagine it depends on the season.
...a favorite insect. I mean, there's certainly certain kinds of insects.
Because you have a family of insects that you really like.
Well, I am fascinated, partly just because of mythology and things, by the scarab beetles. I just think there's so many... And if you go over to our USU insect collection and see the iridescent colors, the greens, the blues of the scarab beetles. So scarab beetles, people might know from, the Egyptian, people would wear that
mummy
as a little
movie.
Talus around their neck. But also, there's a lot of bad pests in that group, too. It's the Japanese beetles in that group, certainly.
Okay.
So our white grub pests that get in our lawns are in that group. So, they're not all good, but they're just amazing to look at, I think. So, but I mean, that said, I have a lot of other insects that I think are pretty cool too. So,
do you have any areas of research that you're concentrating on?
So, my assignment here at Utah State University is to work with horticulturally important pests of insect pests. So I work with fruits and vegetables in particular. So I've done a lot of work with the different insects that attack our fruit crops.
So the fruit flies.
Yeah, the fruit flies, the codling moth, the peach twig borer, those kind. But also I work in a lot with onions, and I work with a little insect called onion thrips.
The thrips.
Yeah, yeah, not that exciting to look at, so to speak, but it's amazing what they can do. And then we're working with one that vectors a virus that's a problem in onion.
And in the last couple of minutes that we have, are there any new insects that have arrived in Utah in the last year or two that we haven't talked about?
Well, we don't. There's this one that we haven't talked about much on this show. We don't know how long it's been in Utah. Probably longer than when we first detected it, but it's called the velvet longhorn beetle. We believe it was brought in on some pallets and wooden materials, that the packing materials they use to bring in, like tiles or other kinds of things that are brought in from Asia once again. But interestingly, it was found quite established in an older cherry, I think it's mostly just sweet cherry orchard in Pleasant Grove in Utah County. And so then it makes us wonder, well, maybe it's been here longer than we thought. And it is known to get in dry wood, but it also, we know now that it also will attack living trees, because it's been boring in these sweet cherry trees in Pleasant Grove for a number of years.
Okay. And so I was thinking that it would be in a conifer, but no.
Yeah,
it sounds
it's a hardwood, and it's supposed to also potentially get an apple and some other kinds of trees, but where this orchard is, there are apple trees nearby. And at this point in time, it's only been found in the sweet cherry.
Are they trying to eradicate it?
Yes, they are. And there's a monitoring program. They've picked it up in a number of places, particularly around kind of some of our industrial areas where a lot of things like pallets get brought into. And so they have an ongoing trapping program. The Utah Department of Agriculture and Food has an ongoing trapping program.
And
too.
Is it a pheromone that they use to attract it?
Yeah. But it's not specific to just this beetle. It's kind of a more general beetle attractant. But it does respond to that, and they have picked it up in traps around. It's not across the state, but it's certainly broader than Pleasant Grove. They picked it up in Salt Lake area, I believe, and in Davis County as well. So
where is it from originally?
Somewhere in Asia.
Of course.
And the problem is when we get these new invasive insects, when you go to look for information, so now they're coming from China, a lot of us don't read Chinese very well. And there's like 2-3 articles out there and they're in Chinese. And so very little information about this particular insect out there. So we're kind of starting from square one.
So if you can read Chinese and are an entomologist, you're in high demand.
That's right. That's a good, good thing to go into now.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. About 30 seconds left. Anything else to wrap up the gardening season? We're just about done.
Yeah, it's been a good gardening season. We had a nice fall it was only just a little bit ago that my tomatoes fully froze here in Cache Valley. So we've had a good season. And
we had zucchini up until 2 weeks ago. So
yeah, get your gardens cleaned out now before the snow piles up and get ready for a great season next year.
Great. Diane, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's Extension Entomologist, and we'll have her back in again beginning in the new year. So stay with us. Coming up next is Petals and Prose. And if you want to know about cooking chicken, this is the one for you.
It's another lovely autumn morning, and I'm here to share autumn morning thoughts with you. I'm Nancy Williams for the Zesty Garden. And for some reason, I'm sure there's nobody else out there like this, but when the weather gets cold and the garden is pretty much gone except for the occasional surviving herb you can find out there or a little bit of spinach, I start dreaming of food, because it's too early to dream out of the new catalogs full of lovely flowers and bulbs. Those don't come until January. So here we are in the fall, thinking about what grows in gardens, but having nothing except what we've canned or frozen out of them. So then I think about, how do I use that? What do I make for dinner that will enhance all those lovely vegetables and herbs? One of my favorite things to do is a roast chicken. And my very favorite recipe for roast chicken comes from Lori Colwin's book, More Home Cooking. Lori Colwin was for years the editor of Gourmet magazine and left us, as part of her legacy, a couple of marvelous cookbooks. They really are cookbooks, but they're full of the essays that she wrote for Gourmet about food. And this is her essay called Roast Chicken. And she says, and I believe totally with her, there is nothing like roast chicken. It is helpful and agreeable, the perfect dish no matter what the circumstances. Elegant or homey, a dish for a dinner party or a family supper, it will not let you down. In the fall, it is uplifting, served with celery remoulade, and it is comforting in the winter with bread and mushroom stuffing. Or it's just the thing for a spring dinner, stuffed with green grapes or half a lemon. In the summer, it's nice to roast your chicken in the morning, let it cool off in the fridge, and serve it cold for dinner. This gels the juices and brings out the chicken flavor. Cold roast chicken, with or without garlic mayonnaise, is my idea of pure heaven. The best chickens are free-range organic birds. This means that they've been left to run around and scratch in the barnyard and have not been packed like rush hour commuters in hen houses to be factory farmed. If you can find them, get them. They turn up at farmers markets or at health food stores and now and again at fancy butchers. In my opinion, the cooks of this country ought to begin a nagging campaign until butchers everywhere make them available. They do cost more, but they taste better. Everything else simply makes do, but some roast chicken is in the end better than no roast chicken. As you approach your bird, you will realize that there is controversy on the subject of roasting time. Some people think chicken should be ever so slightly underdone, pink at the joints, 15 minutes a pound tops is their advice. I, on the other hand, like my chicken roasted until the meat falls off the bone and the skin is very crisp. If you tell people that you roast a 3-pound chicken for almost 3 hours, they gasp with horror. But it must be completely dry, they shriek. Actually, it is completely moist and juicy, crisp and tender all at the same time. The secret is to slow roast it at between 250 and 300 degrees Fahrenheit and baste constantly. I'll interject here. I do mine at 300. This is the chicken of my childhood, and it is the chicken you get at my mother's and sister's houses, and none of us has ever had any protests. The simplest chicken is stuffed with a couple of cloves of garlic and half a lemon. My mother seasons the skin with paprika, salt, and pepper, and so do I. The paprika gives the skin a lovely deep color, a nice crunch, and the merest hint of smokiness. A few green grapes in the cavity of the chicken make an elegant dish. You spill them out into the pan juices, which, when spiked with a drop or two of lemon juice, make a delicious sauce. More down home, but just the thing after a long day, is chicken roasted with vegetables. It's easy, too. A couple of peeled sliced potatoes, carrots, and onions are sautéed in butter and then tipped into the roasting pan. You can season them with thyme or rosemary and pepper. You set the seasoned chicken in the middle of them like an ocean liner amongst tugs, and the result gives you a main course and vegetables. If you happen to have some good whole wheat bread around, dice it up with some chopped porcini mushrooms, toss in butter, and add broth to moisten for a stuffing that's both down home and upscale at the same time. A chicken roasted with little white onions and tiny new potatoes makes an appealing dish. You can mash up the potatoes on your plate and pour the pan juice on top. This is often a hit with young children, who, if they don't like white potatoes, are often mad for little white onions. They can put the whole onion in their mouth or smack it with a fork and watch what looks like a procession of little onions come out of it. Those who eschew fat but still want some roast chicken in their lives can satisfy themselves by removing the crisp skin and giving it to a deserving friend with low cholesterol and pouring all the pan juices and the juice inside the chicken into a bowl. Spoon off the fat and blot what remains away with a paper towel, and then you can have your chicken with a somewhat lighter heart. The trick about roasting chicken is to baste it constantly. This is a boring chore, but well worth the effort. I often like to squeeze the juice of half a lemon over my chicken toward the end, and I roast it for at least 2 hours. I never think in terms of one of time per pound. A chicken has to be in the oven at least 2 hours is my motto. When the leg bone wiggles and the skin is the color of teak, it's time to eat. After you've roasted your chicken, you have two wonderful leftovers to look forward to, a chicken sandwich and chicken broth. A chicken sandwich is a mood elevator. If they were served in prisons, people would commit felonies to get in. A proper chicken sandwich makes a person feel like an indulged child and a sophisticated adult at the same time. With a glass of beer, a glass of wine, or a glass of milk or iced tea, a chicken sandwich makes you feel as if you were sitting in a sunlit tea room at the beginning of spring. Of course, if you are going to feel this way, you must be restrained in your consumption of roast chicken so that you can have half an untouched breast for your sandwich. A well-made chicken sandwich takes hours to prepare. First of all, you must roast your chicken. But second of all, you must make a loaf of bread, the cakey kind of white bread with butter and milk in the dough, as well as a little wheat germ. French bread will not do. You want loaf bread, and it is not easy to find a good white loaf these days. Then, of course, you must make homemade mayonnaise. But many people get around these hurdles by buying bread at the baker's and tarting up prepared mayonnaise with lemon juice. Slice the white meat thin, spread the bread with mayonnaise, and scatter on it a dusting of celery salt or ground celery seed. Some people like an open sandwich and some prefer a lid, but in any case, it is traditional to trim the crusts. This is a matter of taste. On the other hand, toast is not a matter of taste. A chicken sandwich on toast is not, in my opinion, a true chicken sandwich. Now, take the chicken carcass and any gravy you have left, plus any of the roasted vegetables, as well as any other bird bones you happen to have around. Organized types, unlike me, often keep these in the freezer for this purpose. Add filtered water to come 3/4 of the way up and simmer all this for 3 hours. Then strain and keep overnight. The fat that solidifies on top makes a nice airtight lid if you're not going to use the broth for a day or so. But if broth is not in your immediate future, skim off the fat and put the broth in the freezer. It is easier and less messy to get the fat off at this stage. This stock, which will turn to jelly in the fridge, is the basis for millions of good soups. But a very quick soup, loved by adults and children, and by this I mean my husband and my child, is known in our house as hen soup. You dice a medium potato, one small carrot, and one scallion or yellow onion. Put those in a pot with a scattering of lima beans or peas. You can add any other vegetable you like. Zucchini and celery are very nice in this soup. Spoon in enough stock to float the vegetables and simmer. About 10 minutes before serving, break up some spaghetti. A nice addition is the tomato and basil-flavored spaghetti that you can find in the grocery store sometimes, and very hard to find most of the time. Drop the spaghetti in and let it simmer. Add a few drops of lemon juice and a pinch each of pepper and celery salt. If you have any leftover chicken, you can dice it up and put it in too. This, of course, makes the perfect lunch when accompanied by your perfect chicken sandwich. I hope you have a lovely day cooking and smelling good smells in your kitchen and dreaming of your yet-to-come garden of springtime. I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden.
Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.